Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Steve Schweitzer and Mike Cruz, and they'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing Colorado's Indian Peaks Wilderness Area. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Steve or Mike a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Steve and Mike about fly fishing Colorado's Indian Peaks Wilderness Area. Whether fishing for trout in the Rocky Mountains, chasing silver salmon in Alaska, or jumping tarpon in the Florida Keys, the Platte River Fly Shop online store has all the top brands you will need to gear up for your trip. We are Wyoming's largest Sims and Patagonia dealer, keeping a large variety of popular items in stock year-round. You might even find a great deal in our closeout section, from rods and reels to waders and boots. And if you're headed through Wyoming, make sure to put the Blue Ribbon North Platte River Tailwaters on your bucket list. Log on to WyomingFlyFishing.com today and check out our store, or give us a call at 307-237-5997. That's 307-237-5997 or WyomingFlyFishing.com. Our experienced staff will be anxious to help you. Before we introduce Steve and Mike, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership for the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Steve's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Steve and Mike's book, A Fly Fishing Guide to Colorado's Indian Peaks Wilderness Area, courtesy of Steve and Mike and Pixachrome Publishing. Now, here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we have at the end of the show, and the question will be about something we talk about during the show. You must submit your answer, along with your name and your location, using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and maybe you'll win that great book that Steve and Mike have put together. Our guests tonight are Steve Schweitzer and Mike Cruz. Because we were on short notice, I just have an introduction for Steve, but we'll let Mike tell a little bit about himself here as well. Steve has been part of the fly fishing retail and conservation industry for over 20 years, including a key position as the VP of Sales and Marketing at Whiting Farms, where he created the popular products Bird Fur, Fly Tires Variety Pack, and the Whiting Hackle Gauge. He's also served as president of the Lee Wolf Chapter and treasurer of the Illinois Council of Trout Unlimited. Other behind-the-scenes involvement in the industry includes product marketing consulting for leading fly rod and fly tying tool manufacturers, and off and on fly shop rat since the early 90s. Steve is co-founder of the popular international fly fishing website, globalflyfisher.com. Among his 50-plus articles online is Leader Tying Article, Hyper-Complete Guide to Tying Leaders, and accompanying Leader Calc software has surpassed 250,000 downloads since original publication in 1999. Over the years, Steve has authored numerous articles appearing in Fly Fisherman Magazine, Angling Trade, Trout, Wall Street Journal, and a myriad of other regional angling publications. He is also a contributing author and illustrator for the book Drag Free Drift, Presentation Techniques for Fly Fishing, and his fly tying patterns appear in books by Chris Mann, John Shuey, FF Masters, Rick Takahashi, and others. Steve published his first book, A Fly Fishing Guide to Rocky Mountain National Park, in 2011, and his newest book, entitled Fly Fishing Guide to Colorado's Indian Peaks Wilderness Area, was just released in 2014. Steve, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. And Michael, welcome for the first time to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. Mike, you want to just tell them a brief bit about yourself and your background so that we can get a picture of who you are as well?
Well, I've been fly fishing. Well, thank you very much. First of all, I've been fly fishing most of my life. I started when I was about 9 years old. I got actively involved in Trout Unlimited at a pretty early age. I am also the owner of the Laughing Grizzly Fly Shop in Longmont, Colorado. And I guide as well all over the state of Colorado. And pretty much it in a nutshell, I'm a fly fishing junkie. And Steve came to me, or I came to Steve with an idea of possibly doing another book on the Indian Peaks Wilderness area, and here we are today.
Yeah, and that's right. Almost in your backyard, right, Mike?
It is definitely in my backyard. I'm born and raised in Longmont, Colorado, so the Indian Peaks has been stomping grounds my entire life.
Yeah, just over a couple of hills, and you're there, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
Good, good. Okay. Well, we've got lots of questions to go through tonight. I am familiar with a lot of parts of that area myself because I've been backpacking and hiking in that area since I was junior high school, I think. But and lately, the endeavor up there has been searching for wild mushrooms in that Indian Peaks Wilderness area. So there's lots to do up there, including fly fishing, which is great. Let's just start with where the Indian Peaks Wilderness area is, because we do have an international crowd here, and a lot of people aren't familiar with Colorado as I am. So why don't you kind of describe where it is in the world and in the state and its proximity to Denver?
Yeah, sure. Hey, this is Steve. For those who haven't heard my voice yet today, Indian Peaks Wilderness area is directly south and adjacent to Rocky Mountain National Park. And for those who may not know where Rocky Mountain National Park is, it's north and west of Denver by about an hour and a half. So if you go up to Fort Collins, which is directly north of Denver by about an hour and a half in normal traffic conditions, and take a left, you'll eventually run into Rocky Mountain National Park for the most part. Below that then is the Indian Peaks Wilderness area, and it extends down in a somewhat of an hourglass shape, if you were to look at it on the map, with a large northern section, a large southern section with a pinched middle, and it goes down across from the Netherland, Boulder, Colorado area. So it's a long north-south stretch of property just below Rocky Mountain National Park.
And like you said, the proximity is very close to the Denver metro area. I mean, it's a place you can go fish for a day and come home and the same day, which is kind of nice.
Yeah, it's actually closer than Rocky Mountain National Park. You know, Boulder is closer to Denver, and it's just, like you said earlier, it's a hill or two west of Boulder.
Right, right. You want to tell us a little bit about the history of the area itself?
Yeah, kind of interesting. It was actually supposed to be part of Rocky Mountain National Park just about 100 years ago when Enos Mills put together the master plan for land he wanted to protect into becoming eventually what is now known as Rocky Mountain National Park. But unfortunately, the gold and silver mining and the milling and the water rights, the landowners there trumped his efforts to make it a public land. Ironically, only mediocre finds of raw silver and gold ore was found. It was really not super rich in silver or gold. And most of those mining and water rights were abandoned. And eventually, over the years, special interest groups increasingly became more powerful and helped introduce it as becoming a potential federal land. And then in 1978, it actually became a wilderness area under Jimmy Carter through the umbrella of the 1964 Wilderness Area Act. It's been a long time in coming, and in terms of it being a public land for use like a national park, it's relatively new.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember, of course, you know, as every place, not even in restricting to the lower 48, because I used to live in Alaska when I was a kid, but, you know, all these areas have gotten more and more crowded over the years too. So I'm happy to see the protection in place, you know.
Yeah.
But, otherwise, who knows what we'd have if we'd have anything if it wasn't for these protected areas. So it's nice to see that. How does an area become designated as wilderness area? I mean, why it another area?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's not. It looks like it's a cookie cutter formula, but often it's through the efforts of people like you and I that recommend a tract of land, whether public or private, for further designation. There are some hurdles it has to meet. It has to be 5,000 acres or larger. It pretty much has to be roadless and presented as natural, no reconstruction or rehabilitation of the area. It's got to be as it was, you know, 400 or 500 years ago. It has to offer primitive activities like camping and snowshoeing and general outdoor activities that are primitive in nature. Have to offer opportunities of solitude, and that's a written rule within the guidelines of becoming a wilderness area, opportunities for solitude. Mm. And then it certainly has to have economic, geographic, scientific, scenic, and historical significance. Not all of those, but you know, certainly a couple of those to be considered a wilderness area.
I assume that because it was almost included with Rocky Mountain National Park, that kind of helped pave the road for it becoming a wilderness area long term.
Yeah, it's always been natural. It's an extension of Rocky Mountain National Park, and we're so grateful to have it. And there's no roads that go across any of these wilderness like there is in Rocky Mountain National Park with Trail Ridge Road. So it's a little more wild. Yeah,
I think the only road is at the southern end, which is now closed, I believe, the Rollins Pass Road.
That's right, and that's a four-wheel road for the most part when it does open. Yeah,
and that's the lower border of this area, right? So
that's correct, yep.
Between it and Trail Ridge, there's no roads at all, right?
That's absolutely correct. North or south, east or west.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. So for those that haven't been there, why don't you tell us a little bit about the geography of the Indian Peaks Wilderness Area, or as people call it, IPWA, right?
Absolutely, yeah, IPWA. It's about 77,000 acres, so it's not small, but in the scheme of wilderness areas in the United States, it's not the largest. In fact, it ranks over 100, like 110th or 112th or something like that in size. But interestingly, it does span three zones, the montane, the subalpine, and the alpine terrain. So it goes from real low, so below 9,000 feet, and in Colorado terms, below 9,000 feet low, right? And then from 9 to roughly 11,000 feet is that subalpine zone, and above that's alpine terrain. Well, over half of Indian Peaks Wilderness is that subalpine zone between 9 and 11,000 feet, and that's where you're going to find most of your best fishing. But you'll have to spend a little bit of boot leather getting up there. It's a lot of hiking to get to those areas. And on average, the fishing destinations in Indian Peaks Wilderness are about 500 feet higher than in Rocky Mountain National Park. So it's a little higher in altitude. It's more wild, less roads, less trailhead, and more hiking time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are there certain rules and regulations that we should be aware of in IPWA? I mean, is it
different
fishing in a wilderness area than it would be fishing in a...
It's no different than national park in Colorado. So the standard Colorado fishing licenses apply. So if you're coming from out of state, you'll have to get one of those ahead of time. You can even keep fish that you catch. While I don't know the detail and size, I don't have that readily in front of me, but there's roughly 8 fish in aggregate that can be kept. And so there's quite a few species that we'll probably talk about here in a little bit, including cutthroat and brook trout, rainbow, and brown. You can't keep any more than 8 fish in aggregate in any given day per angler. And again, I don't know the slot sizes on sizes, but that can be easily found out through, you know, searching on the web.
Right.
The area is managed in terms of backcountry zones, BCZs, and that's jointly managed by the Colorado Parks and Wildlife and the U.S. Forest Service. Now, the reason I mention that is some BCZs have special camping regulations. You can't camp there during the winter months. There's no fires allowed on the east side of the Continental Divide. And as a point of reference, the Continental Divide kind of divides the park from north to south, where two-thirds of this of IPWA is on the east side of the Continental Divide. Pets are allowed, unlike in national parks like Rocky Mountain National Park, but they have to be on a leash, and that's strictly enforced. So I see that as a benefit because I'm a dog owner, and I love to take my dog fly fishing with him, and she loves to go as well. So as long as it's on a leash, it's a good thing. There are three ATV/Jeep roads that you can use that lead into the wilderness boundary, but only so far. You can't go across the entire Indian Peaks Wilderness. You can only go so far, and then you have to park your ATV or your Jeep and then hike in for the rest of the way. And then finally, the last thing we need to think about here is Brainerd Lake Recreation Area is a highly popular recreation area in the state of Colorado, just outside of Boulder in the Netherland and Ward, Colorado area. That's not part of the Indian Peaks Wilderness. Many people think it is. It's not. It's actually a state recreation area that requires a separate state sticker, separate state access fee. I think it's roughly $7 a day or something like that. But it is a key entry point to the middle central east side of Indian Peaks Wilderness, because right after Brainerd Lake on the west side begins the boundary of Indian Peaks Wilderness. So that's something to take note there.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. I've been up there a bunch of times, but I guess I always figured that was part of it. But
yeah, you'll need a separate sticker to enter that or a day pass. Yep.
Yeah. Speaking of that, and we're going to kind of maybe go through some of these areas, but is the Rainbow Lakes part of the wilderness area, the campgrounds there, or is that?
Yeah, it is. Rainbow Lakes is part of IPWA.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we can cover that
when
detail.
We get to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So the other questions were seasons. And I know when we did the show on Rocky Mountain National Park, we discussed this because the seasons are important to know in Colorado if you don't live here. Because your expectations can be kind of ruined if you don't know about that. So you want to kind of address the seasons that you can fish this area and
yeah,
and
actually, you know what? I may hand this off to Mike. He's the guide, and he fishes a lot more than I do, I hate to say. But Mike, why don't you take that?
Absolutely. Thanks, Steve. Yeah, the seasons in the Indian Peaks Wilderness area, because it's high altitude, the season is not a long one. In fact, in the majority of the places, say Brainerd Lake Road doesn't even open until mid-June. And it's closed up again by the 1st of October. So the season is relatively short for the, the drive-in traffic to a drive-in to a trailhead and get out and hike type atmosphere. But if you're into snowshoeing and things like that, for the hiking atmosphere of it, it's pretty much a year-round thing as long as you can get in and out of some of those trailheads like the Hesse Trailhead, which gives you a lot of opportunity for different areas to go to. The drawback about the altitude is the freeze, the ice up and the ice off dates. And for instance, Steve and I hiked into a lake this year, a very grueling hike. And as we got higher, it got colder. And this is in the middle of July, the second or third week of July. And we get up to the lake and it's half to two thirds frozen. So it really depends on what kind of summer you're having, what kind of spring you're having, and how quick your thaw came, so you can judge it or base it based on the runoff situation, how your rivers are doing down locally. But I'd say your average dates, would a really good date to go by would be the third or fourth week of June all the way into mid-September would be basically your times that you could actually get in there and really open up and fish most of these places.
And still be prepared for winter camping, right?
Absolutely.
I know once we were going up Flat Tops Wilderness Area. And we're climbing up towards the top, and down come some rangers, and they said, and this was the second week in July, and they stopped us and said, are you folks prepared for winter camping? And we looked at each other and we go, oh, yeah, yeah. We really weren't, because it was the second week in July. But sure enough, we got over the crest of the pass there, and it started snowing, you know. So you never know what you're going to get coming from the other side of the mountain.
Absolutely. Steve and I, in fact, the very last hike of the book, if I'm not mistaken, I believe it was in the second week of August, and we got up to altitude, which was about 11,000 for our first lake, and we went up to about 11,600 for the second lake we hit that day, and on the way up, we went from 45, 50-degree temps down to, we honestly weren't truly prepared for it. It got very cold, started hailing on us, the wind picked up, and we both had jackets and rain gear, but it was we weren't prepared for that much of a fall in temperature, so it was a little of a shock to us as well, and we're in there all the time, and we both felt pretty crazy that we didn't pack a little bit better just in case we were to get stuck in there overnight.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of people think I'm silly because I always take survival gear even on day hikes, you know. But I've read too many stories about people having to spend the night when they weren't prepared, you know, and it doesn't always turn out too well. So, well, good. So we know what the seasons are, and maybe you can address this too, Mike. Tell us about the fish that are available in throughout the area. And I know it varies from water to water, but what in general can we look forward to?
Well, in general, and it does vary water to water, but in general, it's a vast majority of brookies. Through all the lower parts of all the streams are mostly inhabited by brookies. And as you climb a little higher, you start getting into some of the cutthroat brookie mix. And as you get up into most of the lakes, a great majority of the lakes are filled with cutthroats. And there are a few of the lakes that actually have splake in them, or at least one that we came into in particular. And it was a shock to us. We were catching brookies, and all of a sudden there was a very, very nice-sized splake that came out after when Steve caught. There is only one lake in the Indian Peaks Wilderness area that does have the, we're going to call it the greenback, but it is Lake Gibraltar, and that is the only lake that we're aware of that has a greenback in it. The other lakes are going to be a broken-down variety, again, of brookies. Some cutthroats, you get down to the lower regions, you run into some browns. Rainbows are probably the hardest fish to find in the Indian Peaks. Though they are there, you have to come down a little bit lower in the altitudes to down around the entrances to some of the trailheads.
Hmm. So primarily the upper lakes would have the cutthroats in them. Rather than
Correct.
Streams and so forth. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Now, do all the creeks and streams and rivers and lakes, do they all have fish?
No, they do not. And it is broken down. Some of the places that would not inhabit the DOW, the Forest Service and DOW get together, and they decide what's going to be the best habitational aspects for some of these fish. And some of these lakes are stocked. Some of them have a natural reproduction to them. So not everything in there is going to have a annual supply of fish. There's a particular hike that Steve and I went on where we were told there were no fish in these two particular lakes. We decided to hike down to them anyway, and we found an abundance of fish. So that it does filter around and it does happen. But when they say it's barren, doesn't always mean it's 100% barren all of the time. It just means that they're not stocking it, but fish can filter in and out of it. It can winter kill, so it's not a place where it's going to have a sustained life for fish. But it's probably in the range of about 30% or so, I think, that is uninhabited.
I notice in your book, in the back there, you have a chart telling by each fishery, what's in there or whether it's barren or not. So is your indication of barren in your book from the state, or is that your personal experience?
It is 100%. I'm sorry, Steve. It is 100% personal experience from what we've got. But then there is some aspect of it that the DOW, a contributing author, Ben Swiggle, gave us information that led us to whether or not it did or didn't have fish in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can add to that, that not all lakes and streams are surveyed every year just because of the sheer time it takes to go to the 81 lakes in the wilderness area plus the 42 streams that they've recorded. Roughly, I would say 10% is surveyed at any given year. So we were privy to the survey records and the stocking records over the years. And some of that's historical, but we went to every location regardless, just because we wanted to know for accuracy in the book at the time the book was published, to make sure it's, you know, as accurate as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to say that no stocking of brook trout has happened since 1977. So it's all natural reproduction at this point. And even that lake that we talked about, where we saw the splake or caught the splake have never been introduced in that lake per any stocking records that anybody knows about. So the presumption there is that was a naturally produced splake.
Hmm. That's pretty cool. Well, brookies do pretty good on their own, don't they?
Yeah, kind of like the high country bluegill, you know.
I've never heard it put that way, but that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But they make fun fishing and a good supper once in a while. So.
Doubt on that.
I need to take a quick break here, guys, but when we come back, we'll dig more into the Indian Peaks Wilderness Area and see what we can learn. Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services they offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Steve Schweitzer and Mike Cruz about fly fishing Colorado's Indian Peaks Wilderness Area. If you'd like to ask Steve or Mike a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, guys, I do have a question came in. I don't have a name on it, but the question is this a trip a 57-year-old flatlander in decent shape can accomplish? Why fish here, in other words, IPWA, rather than the other 1,000 great places to fish in Colorado? So, one of you want to take that one?
Go ahead, Mike.
Excellent. That's an excellent question, actually. The best way I can summarize that would be you get up into the Indian Peaks Wilderness area, and you lose all your inhibitions. You're all alone. You get off the beaten path. There's no other fishermen. It's very secluded. It's a beautiful place. There's beautiful animals everywhere. And the fishing is spectacular. I guess that's probably the best answer I can give to why you'd want to go up there versus anything else. There's a lot of beautiful places to go, but this is... it is a spectacular place, and yes, a 57-year-old flatlander could definitely handle a majority of these hikes.
And maybe we can kind of talk about that as we take a tour of the wilderness here next. So, because you don't have to necessarily hike up to 11,600 feet to get good fishing, right?
No, you do not. You can start, on average, it does start a little bit higher. And I heard you earlier bring up Rainbow Lakes. Rainbow Lakes is a hike that almost anybody could do. And if their path were a little bit better, you could almost get a wheelchair up there.
Right.
So it's a very easy place to get to, and there's some beautiful fishing in there. So it doesn't have to be a very difficult hike. It just, the further you go, the deeper you go, if you're willing to put in the effort, you're going to find a lot of really solid rewards.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's always the case with fishing, though, isn't it? I mean, you go to any river, and if you're willing to walk a block further or half a mile further, you usually get further away from the people, and the fishing usually gets better. So that a little work always pays off, I found. So another question on the Internet came in. Tim from Superior, Colorado. He says, does your book go outside the IPWA boundaries at all? Specifically, I'm thinking about fishing opportunities in the James Peak area.
Yeah, it doesn't cover James Peak, and we bantered that about a lot as we were putting the book together. So, no, it doesn't include James Peak, but it does include the Brainerd Lakes Recreation Area as part of being, you know, a good jumping-off point into Indian Peaks Wilderness Area.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Well, I'm sure a lot of the techniques we talk about and so forth would apply there as well. It's just he won't have as good a guide to go there as you guys have put together. And, you know, just to kind of promote getting this book is, you know, and just the chart in the back alone of what fish are where and whether the fishery is barren or not could save you a ton of walking. So that alone, I think, makes the book worth its weight right there. So,
yeah, the chart, we spent a lot of time making sure it's accurate, at least at the point of publication. And like Mike said, these rivers and lakes change. You know, 10 years from now, there'll be different lakes that have different fish in them just by natural migration and flooding and maybe new stocking habits that the Forest Service puts in place. But interestingly, the question before about a 57-year-old man in decent shape hiking, we do include a chart in the back of the book that rates all the hikes that we talk about by trail in the book, rates them like one hiker to five hikers. And of course, five hikers is the most difficult trails and are often multi-day backpacks. And the, you know, one hiker is the easiest, almost drive-by locations and hikes that you could do. So we do help you plan out to the level that you want to participate in, what hikes you want to take care of as you knock them off on your checklist. So.
Sure. Yeah. Terrific. Another valuable resource there for sure. Okay. Let's kind of take a walk through the wilderness area. And I know you guys broke this down into seven areas and in your book, and maybe we could kind of, I don't know if you did that north to south or south to north. Or...
Yeah, it, essentially the map that we provide in the book is essentially starts at the 1 o'clock position at our area 1 and rotates clockwise around until we reach area 7. And I'll just, you know, cover those real quickly, and then maybe we can field questions on specific areas. But, you know, the first area to 1 o'clock position is the middle St. Vrain drainage, all right? So it's also the area that touches Rocky Mountain National Park, so it's going to look most like Rocky Mountain National Park in geography. Then just south of that, at the, like, 3 o'clock position, is the Brainerd Lake entryway, and we've already talked about that. It's, you know, quick access. It's a lot of short hikes. You got plenty of fishing, like Mitchell Lake, Blue Lake, Long Lake, Isabel. You know, those are all within a mile or two of hiking and a lot of easy hiking to get some high altitude lakes. So that's a great jumping off point. The lower third, we combine like areas 3 and 4 together, since area 3, which is essentially the Rainbow Lakes area, is essentially only Rainbow Lakes. There's nothing else there. But we combine area 3 and 4 together, and that's the Middle Creek, or Middle Boulder Creek drainage. And that takes you to a lot of some of Mike and I's favorite lakes, you know, Lost Lake, King Lake, Steady and Bob, Jasper Creek, Woodland Lake, Storm Lake, lots of great fishing for native cuts in those lakes. As we kind of round about the 6 o'clock hour going back up on our clock, we talk about Area 5, and that spans across the Continental Divide and covers the North Fork of the Middle Boulder Creek drainage. Okay, and that takes us into Diamond Lake, Deep Lake, Banana Lake. Again, some fantastic fisheries and some day hikes. Those aren't very difficult to get to as a day hike. Then that, remember if I talked about the hourglass shape earlier, that central area is the skinniest part. We refer to that as Area 6. And that's essentially the Arapahoe Cascade Creek drainages. And they drain into Monarch Lake, which is almost near Grand Lake on the far west side of Rocky Mountains there, between Rocky Mountain National Park and Indian Peaks Wilderness. There are a couple cool lakes to consider. Now, thinking, though, that Arapahoe and Cascade Creek, they're long creeks, 6 and 7 miles long, even to get to Mirror Lake and Crater Lake, which are some two fun lakes to fish. So you got to think about that as being almost an overnighter unless you want to do 14 or 15 miles of hiking plus a couple hours of fishing. All right. And then finally, that Area 7 is the upper western section. It's very remote. It's not easy to get to. You kind of have to get to it with some dirt roads and some long hikes from Monarch Lake Trailhead. But it takes you to places like Watonga Lake, Gord Lake, Long Lake. Now, there's two Long Lakes, by the way. There's a Long Lake on the west side and a Long Lake on the east side. So you got to be careful of that when you research Long Lake in the book. Stone and Upper Lakes. Now, interestingly, there's a canyon that's accessed through Area 7 called Hell Canyon. And I'm here to tell you it's aptly named. So don't plan a trip unless you are very confident of your backpacking skills. It definitely is an overnight or two. I think Mike and I made it 3 nights. I can't remember that hike, how many nights we stayed, but lots of great fishing, but it takes a lot to get there.
Okay. So that's a good rundown of the general areas. Let's see if we can maybe kind of highlight even more, particularly a fishery in each one of those areas, if you can. Starting with Area 1, is there a particular fishery there that is
special? Yeah, I'll tell you what, I'll take Area 1 and 2, and then maybe Mike can do 3, 4, and 5, and kind of split it up because we each have our own experiences that are our favorites, and we've talked about this many times amongst ourselves. But in Area 1, it's best accessed with an ATV out of the Camp Dick, public camping ground, and the trailhead kind of takes off from Camp Dick. And there's parking there for your trailer and your truck, and you can take your ATV in for about 4.5 miles. But then you have to park it and hike it the rest of the way because you've entered then into Indian Peaks Wilderness Area. And no motorized vehicles are allowed in Indian Peaks Wilderness Area. But there's great fishing all along the motorized trail. And then, you know, once you get off of your ATV, like what we used, and we hiked up to Red Deer Lake and camped there one night, beautiful lake. I think one of our favorite lakes to fish was Gibraltar Lake, where in the second week of August or the first week of August, I can't remember, was 50% covered in ice. And we were walking across snow fields, albeit very carefully, to get to that lake. But then we found lots of hungry fish. It was ice out fishing. And we hit it just at the right time. And if anybody's ever done ice out fishing, you know what I'm talking about. It's a very magical moment. So that's Area 1. And again, it's best used with an ATV as primary access half the way. Area 2, essentially the Brainerd Lake access. And I like this as day hike stuff, particularly when friends meet me from out of state and they want to go do a little bit of fly fishing for an afternoon. It's quick access, particularly in the summer when the road is open clear to Brainerd Lake, and plenty of parking. There's, you know, you can do a mile hike, you can do a 2 mile hike, you can go a half a mile and reach different lakes that are, you know, full of brookies and native cuts. And then, of course, fishing the streams that flow in and out of those lakes. So there's lots of opportunity there. So maybe I'll stop there and let Mike cover, you know, areas 3, 4, and 5.
Yeah, before you go on there, yeah, there are, what, kind of 4 major lakes in that area, would you say? Blue, Mitchell, Long, and Isabel?
That's absolutely. And each so Blue is the longest hike. It's just a couple miles. Mitchell is just about a couple miles, and then Long and Isabel are connected to each other, and a 15-minute walk gets you to Long. So,
yeah, that's why you're saying that's a good area for being guests from out of state, where you can access quickly for the day and
yeah.
get in and out.
Yeah, you know, interestingly, I don't know if anybody's going to ask this question, but I'll throw it out there as an answer. It's not really a best practice to take in a float tube. Now, people float tube Brainerd Lake because it's a drive-by lake. You can just literally just park your car and just take out your float tube and plop it in the water. You can also take it to Long or Isabel. It's, you know, it's only a mile carry. But really beyond that, most people don't use float tubes at these high altitude lakes. Plus, if you've ever heard one of my presentations on fishing high altitude lakes, the fish aren't really hungry in the middle. They're hungry when they're at the shoreline, cruising the shores, looking for the bugs in the warmer water. So float tube really doesn't give you any advantage.
Yeah, yeah. Good point to make, yeah, because I know that was the question that was kind of lurking in my mind. The I remember back when I was 18, and this has changed before, but we backpacked into Blue Lake on a full moon and spent the night up there. And that's one thing that I think people need to be aware of, too, is back then you didn't need a permit to camp. You just went up and you camped. And now I know Blue Lake has changed specifically to where you have a designated spot there to camp, and they control the access and so forth. So that's something that if you're coming from out of state, you need to be aware that you need to get camping permits in advance to many of these areas.
Yeah. And that's a great point. That is applicable to all of IPWA now.
Okay.
So just free-form backcountry zone camping, you have to get your permit. And it's really a safety issue. You know, the authorities want to know who's in there in case something happens, like a wildfire. They want to know how many campers are in there that we need to go rescue. You know, so it's not really a money maker because it doesn't cost a lot of money. In fact, I didn't even forget how much it costs, but it's not a lot. It's more about a safety factor and knowing who's in the backcountry at any given night.
Yeah, yeah. But that's one thing that's pretty cool as I remember it is, you know, walking around under a full moon at night up at Blue Lake where you thought, you know, it looks like you're on the moon, feels like you're on the moon, you know.
Pretty in fact, Mike and I camped at the Coney Lakes, I believe, this summer. And we awoke to just a beautiful morning, and there was a moose down at one of the lakes that we were, you know, watching and taking photos of, and ran across a mountain sheep that had actually bedded down not 20 yards from our tent the entire night.
Oh,
wow.
We
never heard them. Yeah. And it's just amazing to be out there with wildlife and just be part of it and be accepted like they are.
Yeah, yeah. Cool. Hilarious. Okay, Mike, you want to take over and move on to the next area?
Sure, absolutely. So Area 3 is pretty much just the Rainbow Lakes area, and it kind of sticks off on a little finger all by itself on the east side of the Indian Peaks. And there are basically made up 9 lakes in the Rainbow Lakes area. And though I have found fish in almost all 9 of those lakes at some given time or another, there are lakes that are considered to be barren. And we do give that information in the book. So lakes 1, 2, 4, 5, and 9 have, by the DOW, Parks and Wildlife, have considered to be barren because of the depth of the lakes themselves. They look at those as winter killing every year. So all those lakes are fairly well connected, so fish do migrate back and forth. But the unfortunate part is the ones that get into those lakes probably do perish at the end of every season. And then lakes 3, 6, 7, and 8 are actually very, very wealthy with fish. They're fun fisheries, and it's that one, the question we had about a 57-year-old Flatlander, that's a specific place where they can go and really get into some pretty nice fishing with a very little hike. And the river coming out of it also would be a really good place to find some good pocket water fishing. And so that would be basically your Rainbow Lakes area.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so moving on, since that is such a small area, we'll step up and go to Area 4. And Area 4 is basically centered right above Nederland, Colorado, and it's off the Hesse Trailhead. And most of all this, you can access it from both sides of the Continental Divide, but the best access is from right above Nederland on the Hesse Trailhead. And you have, oh my gosh, you have Betty and Bob and King Lake, which are all three very close together. And I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, we were hiking up to King Lake, and it's a pretty daunting hike. And the trail itself is just beautiful with wildflowers. They were in full bloom when we went up there, and we're pushing on. It's about 7 or 8 miles in, and so we get up there, and we finally get up to King Lake, and I'm exhausted. And Steve Brule breaking out lunch, and I look up, and there's two gentlemen at the very top of the glacier on the far side of the lake, and they're skiing down the glacier towards the lake. And I thought, oh my gosh, those guys packed their skis up here and they're skiing down the face of this mountain. And about that time I get this reflection in my eyes, and I look up, and their Jeep is parked on top. So they took the Corona Pass trail up from the other side, and they actually so I looked at Steve and I said, you made me hike up this? We could have driven.
I had the same experience, and I think Heart Lake is out of the Indian Peaks Wilderness area. But, you know, off of Rollins Pass, you can go left and go up to Heart Lake. It's like a five-mile trek up there. And I did that, too. I went up there, and I started to fish, and I look up, and there's these people on the other side of the lake. I said, how did they get here? And the same thing, they came over from Winter Park, parked on the top, and then hiked down. I was really, really kind of bent out of shape that I had walked 5 miles to get to this remote lake, and somebody had walked about two blocks, you know. So I know how you feel.
It's exactly right. And when those guys got to the bottom of the glacier, and that's when I noticed the Jeep, because they took their skis off, they put them on their back, and they started hiking back up the mountain, and I thought, man, that must have been a fun ride, because they're going to go do it again. But they were actually hiking out back up to their truck that was parked on top.
Yeah. Interesting. Funny, but it's another spot. I have to remember that one.
It is beautiful, though. It's a gorgeous lake. And directly adjacent to the northeast of King Lake would be Betty and Bob. And it's both Betty and Bob have beautiful cutthroats in them, and that's another fantastic place to hike over to. And it would be, you know, if you're really hardcore hiker, very athletic, you could do that in a day hike. We did do it in a day hike, and it was very aggressive. But you're looking at, you know, if you went to all three lakes in one day, you're looking at about a 17, 18-mile day. So, it's definitely not for the lighthearted on a day hike, but it would be a good overnighter, where you could hit all three lakes and give it the quality time.
Mm-hmm.
And then in and amongst all of that, you have Jasper Creek, and I know I kind of giggled there. And Jasper Creek is the creek where Steve found out that you cannot allow Mike to build a rod on the way up a hike because you won't get him off the water. And Jasper
Creek. My rule of thumb. I'll interrupt you. My rule of thumb is when we're hiking to a destination lake, you hike to the lake first and you fish your way back. Otherwise, if you allow people like Mike to assemble a rod and fish on the way up, we don't ever make it to the lake. So I had to almost take that rod away from him and break it in half. We ended up didn't make it up there, but like you said, Jasper Creek is a creek that is just chock full of fish. It's in some places only 4 or 5 feet wide. That's just a fun little creek to fish.
Yeah, and that's one thing you guys haven't really talked about too much is on the way to most of these lakes, there's a lot of creek and stream fishing on the way up, like you just described, right? Or on the way down.
You know, it's interesting. many of these trails that we talk about, many of the trails in the book, follow a stream.
Right.
And most often those streams have fish in them. Rarely do you find a stream next to a trail that's barren. So even if the weather sets in or you find that that hike is just too much for you and you don't want to go further, you still have plenty of fishing opportunities right next to you that you can fish your way back, particularly on a stream.
Yeah, right. Well, let's before we go on, let me take a quick break, and then we'll come back, finish up a couple areas, and then talk about some techniques that you guys have discovered work best for you in these areas. So just give me a quick few seconds, and we'll be right back. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 31 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging onto their website at frontrangeanglers.com. That's frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Steve Schweitzer and Mike Cruz about fly fishing Colorado's Indian Peaks Wilderness Area. If you'd like to ask Steve or Mike a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Mike, we're on to Area 5.
Yeah, Area 5. So as we look at Area 5, it's kind of a more remote area, and it does traverse both sides of the Continental Divide. And it's not hard to access. In fact, there's a very good trailhead that goes up in there, and it's off the 4th of July trailhead. And it's the reason it's so hard or backcountry-ish is because it does traverse both sides of the Continental Divide. So you actually go up at around 12,000 feet if you're traversing over to drop down into some of the lakes on the other side. And some of the lakes we went to this year, in the book you'll see we have a lake called Deep Lake that's not on the maps, but it is a lake that is inhabited with fish. Also, we went over to Diamond, Upper Diamond, Banana, which are really not on the maps either. Diamond Lake is, but Banana and Upper Diamond are not. They're projected as a blue dot on the map, but there is no name given to them. And these were some of the best hikes, some of my most memorable hikes. I enjoyed it a lot. And I did a couple of them, or we did, I should say, a couple of them coming over from the other side where we started at Meadow Creek Reservoir, and we hiked in on the Junco Lake Trail and went up and over Caribou Pass and around to Lake Dorothy and dropped into Caribou Lake, which is 1,500 vertical feet down from the trail which we were on. It's breathtaking. And some of the photos in the book kind of depict what we were looking at. In all of the areas, it's probably my favorite just because of the altitude and what you're looking at and the weather, how quickly it changes. And when a cloud rolls in, it just doesn't roll in. It comes in and sucks the place down. So it goes from sunny and beautiful, and 15 minutes later, 30 degrees colder and completely socked in. So that is an area where you really need to pay attention to what you're bringing up with you.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then Neva, also in there is Neva Lakes, Lower Neva Lakes, and then Columbine Lake, which is on the west side of the Continental Divide, and it kind of sits all by itself, and it's one of those hikes, again, if you came in from Meadow Creek Reservoir, that somebody who's not superiorly fit could do this hike easily in a day. It's almost flat all the way to the base of the lake, and then it has about a 500 or 600 vertical foot climb to the lake itself, and that's another one where you could get to very easily.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the fishing is ultra phenomenal in all those lakes.
Okay. On to 6.
And And then six would take us into the Arapaho backcountry zone. And that's what Steve was talking about earlier, where those are hikes and those are places to go that are going to require a lot more effort, possibly overnight stays. So as you're hiking into, let's say, Cascade Creek, going up towards Crater Lake, that's going to be, depending on which side you come from, if you come from Monarch Lake or if you come from Brainerd Lake, you're looking at about 9 miles, 9 to 10 miles from each one of those directions. So as you hike into these particular lakes in Area 6, those are the ones where you're looking truly at a possible overnight stay.
Mm-hmm.
And the rivers that flow, like Cascade Creek, flows along the entire trail, with the exception of a few places where it diverts. And also Arapaho Creek flows all the way up through to Caribou Lake. So that's almost 9 miles of good quality stream fishing. And I know, Roger, you mentioned earlier that, you know, we didn't say a whole lot about the streams, but we're talking about the lakes. Well, the streams are my passion. And we do talk about them in the book a little bit, but those are the places where people need to look and find them and work them on their own and find the passion in some of those streams and how well they really fish. So we don't highlight a whole lot on the streams, and it's not that we don't want people to fish them. It's just those are places where you need to look and do some of the research and figure out how to fish some of those places and get the bounty that comes out of them, because they're full of fish. But it's an excellent place to go and learn.
Right, right. Okay, and then lastly, Area 7.
And I'll let Steve take Area 7.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, we did Area 7. It's a pretty large area as the areas the way we chunk it out for the book. It's super remote. There's only a couple trails that go up into that area to explore, like Batanga and Gord Lake. One hike we did in particular to Round Lake, which is kind of off trail and way off trail. So it's totally off trail, backcountry. Use your map, use your GPS, use your compass type of find this lake sort of hike. Stone Lake, we camped at Stone Lake, and if you ever want to hike up there to Stone Lake, it's quite an ascent up to Stone, which is at kind of the top of Hell Canyon, which I referenced earlier. But the camping is phenomenal. I mean, it's just beautiful, just the camping setting. You're camping right on the edge of the lake almost, and the lake it just boils with fish at hatch time. And then, of course, we got the upper lakes as well up there. But then you go down into Hell Canyon. There's a couple lakes down there Mike mentioned earlier that we didn't have any data on for fish, but we did find fish in those lakes. Not as populous, but there were fish there, and we caught some. But that area can get socked in with weather where the rest of the Colorado could have blue, sunny skies. I think the only cloud in all of Colorado that day we were there was over Hell Canyon that had dumped on us. And it made things very cold and very wet. And so, again, you got to be prepared, like you cautioned us earlier. So, again, Area 7, very remote. Be prepared for it, but the rewards are well worth the travel on this hike.
Would you say, is Area 7 then, did you say that was probably the most remote area out of the whole wilderness area?
I would think so, yes. Yep. It's right in the middle, like you characterized it well, between the bottom of Indian Peaks Wilderness, where you have Rollins Pass and the road there, and then up to Trail Ridge Road, which is essentially in the upper third of Rocky Mountain National Park, there's no roads. Well, Area 7 is right in the middle of that.
Mm-hmm.
No road zone. So
yeah.
I think
it's
pretty remote. Yeah.
Okay. Good. Okay, let's talk specifically about some of the equipment you might need in the area. First of all, what do you guys pack in for rods? Any particular rig you use more than others?
Okay. What I do, Roger, actually is I pack in a 4-weight rod. and I use it basically for the streams and the lakes themselves. I used to pack in two rods and try and go that route with like a 5-weight and a 3-weight. It became too much weight. So what I started to do is just, I settled with a 4-weight and I just decided to make it work for both the stream and the lake atmosphere. And it works really well. And I would say that would probably be the best suited way to go if you're only going to pack in one type of rod.
Okay. And then, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask you about any special leader or tippet setup you use. I mean, I think we had a question later on about, let's see. Camilo Santana in Massachusetts asked, when fishing the wilderness area, is the majority of the time spent nymph fishing or dry fishing? And that may relate to, you know, your leader and tippet setup.
Absolutely. There isn't much of a call for anything super special in terms of leader and tippet. What I go up there with is typically 5, 6, and 7X. I do have a tendency to overpack a little bit, but I like to be fully prepared. And I find that I use a 5X leader with 6X tippet probably 80 to 90% of the time. And my typical rig for the lakes, referring to the question you just had about, the dry fly and so forth, my typical rig for almost every lake I hit is going to be some type of a stimulator or a terrestrial dry, and then I run a dropper down below that, and I gauge the dropper basically to the depth of the water, or what I think the depth of the water is going to be on my cast, to give myself the better opportunity for the fish. But in terms of leader and tippet, it's not rocket science in the sense, don't overthink it. I do have a tendency to do that because I don't want to get caught without the proper equipment. But in all true essence, 5X leader with a 6X tippet will probably get you by 90% of the time.
Okay. We'll talk about flies here in a minute because I'd like to dig deeper into that. But regarding other equipment, Tom in Roswell, Georgia asked, you know, what is the essential equipment you always take with you? And considering we're backpacking and trying to go light, any special considerations there?
Absolutely. And you know, Steve and I talked about, you know, and you also mentioned getting caught not being prepared. Even on these day hikes, you have to take into Mother Nature's account. So as you're doing a day hike, you need to have proper rain gear. You need to have something warm to put on in case the temps should drop, and be properly ready for, you know, weather changes. And then aside from that, definitely want a good water bottle and a water filter so that you can refill constantly and keep yourself hydrated. And that's one of the biggest mistakes that people make going into the high country is hydration. Mm-hmm. They don't feel like they're thirsty until it's too late, and then the headache and the severe case starts. And so other than your actual fishing gear itself, just be very well prepared for any type of temperature change or any change that could, you know, infringe you to even possibly have to stay the night unannounced.
Right. We did have a question about personal watercraft, and I noticed Phil in California wrote in online about asking about float tube. And I think Steve already addressed that, you know, it's not a recommended practice in the wilderness area. Am I correct?
You're absolutely correct, and it's not a recommended practice, and it's not that it's frowned upon. Number one, hiking a float tube into some of these areas would be a very difficult task. But the other aspect of it, as you step into a lake, I personally can't recall in the Indian Peaks area in the last 3.5 years where I physically got into the water and waded. And the reason I didn't do that was because of the life structure that you destroy with every step you take. The shelf that's there underneath the water has all kinds of microorganisms and life in there. And as we walk through it, we disturb it, we destroy it. And it's not out of necessity, because most of these areas, especially in these lakes, you can access very good fishing from the shores. And some of it may be a little difficult. It may promote a little casting technical aspect of it. But I found no need to actually get in and wade any of these waters. I mean, I think Steve will agree with me 100%. I don't think there's a true necessity to actually get in and actually mm-hmm. wade these waters.
Right. Well, I'd much rather not pack in a float tube, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. One question I meant to ask earlier is, no grayling in any of these lakes that you found, right?
We did not catch any grayling, and I don't believe that there is any literature saying that there has been grayling in there, but there was also never any literature on that splake either, and we were very surprised when we pulled that out of the water, but we have seen nothing of any grayling.
Okay. So, and you mentioned, you know, stepping into the water, it just made me think, it's kind of like, you know, when you're above timberline, it's the same as the tundra, you know, delicate environment that has very little time to regenerate every year, and the more pressure we put on it, the harder it is for it. So, like the tundra, like the water, I suppose.
Absolutely. It's related definitely to the fact of, you know, that is a very delicate life in that 6 to 10 inches of water that you'll see on the shelf that there's really no need to disturb.
All right. Let's talk about food and flies. What, in this high country, what are the fish generally feeding on? And, you know, along with that, do we need to be prepared to match the hatch up there? Or is that overkill for these areas?
Actually, I'd say it's not overkill to look at matching the hatch. I have been to several of the lakes where it's kind of anything goes. You put it on and they take it. But then there's the few lakes where they are very in tune or geared towards what's coming off. And they're not taking just anything you want to put out there. And we ran into a few of those lakes that were actually very technical. And in that aspect of it, you couldn't just blindly put something on and put a dropper on and throw it out and say, hey, I got a fish. So, yes, there was some avenues where you did or had to be prepared to actually match a hatch. Not in all cases by any means. Stimulators work very well at some of the reproduction or matching some of the hatches, but very few select of them were a blueing olive or a spinner of some sorts. It just, that's what the fish wanted to see, and they weren't going to take anything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would add to the pickiness that typically when fish are picky, they're going to want something darker and smaller on average. That's just my experience, maybe not Mike's. It's interesting. We both tried our own tactics on many lakes where, you know, tough fishing or finicky fishing, using very different flies, very different rigs, and very different setups. And we both caught fish. So there is no one answer. But in my experience, the higher you go, the food sources are typically smaller and typically darker. And so I would often, on a picky day, a picky fishing day, I'd start with a small, like size 18 ant, black ant. If they didn't want that, I'd go smaller to a mosquito, like a size 20 mosquito of some sort, or a para tackled atoms of some sort. So that worked for me. You know, Mike often tried different droppers that were super effective too. So you never know where they're going to feed, you know, foot below the surface of the water or on the surface. You got to try both. I often just gave up quickly and took a nap on a big flat rock. And then actually the fish on the back cover of the book, Mike caught when I was napping. And it ended up being one of the bigger fishes caught during all of our research. So,
kudos to him. Yeah, it is a nice looking fish. So what, you know, you talked about like fishing the lakes, doing a, you know, an attractor and then a dropper off of that as kind of a standard rig. What are you using for the dropper? Where do you start, you know, what do you use as a kind of a searching pattern on the dropper?
I have a standard go-to dropper, and it's a Prince nympha, and I use one of two Prince nymphs, either the purple Prince or a standard Prince nymph, and a size 16, and that is my standard dropper. So as I'm fishing across the shelf, and you look to the edge of the shelf, I want to gauge my dropper to be close to where that shelf bottom is. So if it looks like it's about 3 feet deep or so, then I put about a 3 foot dropper on, or 2.5 feet. If it looks to be 5 feet, then I'll put a much better dropper on, or much deeper dropper. And that, I gauge it that way, and you'll catch those fish hanging off the edge of that littoral shelf. So that's how I start my day, and then I kind of move it around from there. I've actually had fish, Roger, take my Prince nymph and my dry fly in the same time. When I pulled the fish in, he had the dry fly and the Prince nymph in his mouth. So it's just a flat-out hungry fish. He doesn't have much time to eat, so he was taking all the food he could see.
Yeah, yeah. What other, I know you have a whole section in your book on flies here, but what are some of the other go-to patterns that you find being most successful?
Well, I like the, like I said, I like the Prince nymph, but I also like a nice ant pattern. And I have a pattern that actually is not in this book. It's in Steve's first book, and it's called the Covered Ant. And in the Rocky Mountain National Parks book, it is in that one. I chose not to put it into this book just so we could put other patterns from other guides and anglers in it as well. So I like the ant patterns. I think they work really well, because they do flourish the area, and they get carried by the anabatic winds. So the ants get dropped into the lake quite frequently, so the fish do feed on them in big numbers, actually. Another pattern, any type of coronamid-type pattern would work really well. Not all the time, as you know. Nothing always works all the time, but a little standard bomber coronamid, like they call it the ice cream cone, that would be another good pattern that I would go to.
Mm-hmm. What about in the streams? Primarily dry fly?
Yeah, I'm all about the streams and dry fly. That, for me, is where I love to put out and match the hatch a little bit. You know, if I see a crane fly, if I see a blueing olives or some rusty spinners or something coming off, I love matching the hatch on the streams. And that truly is a passion for me. The streams for me are where it's all at. And I love the lakes too, but there's always a step above something you love, and the streams have to be it for me.
Yeah, I would add that on these streams, oftentimes in just maybe a 10-yard stretch of a stream, you're going to see a hatch just in 10 yards. And it's a little cloud of bugs just right over a certain section of the river. And it doesn't mean that it's often like a drake or a caddis, like a gray drake or like a size 14, tan caddis would work well. Doesn't mean those dry fly patterns wouldn't work elsewhere in the stream, but it's just unique that it's not like fishing the Colorado or the Roaring Fork or any tailwater hatch in the summer here in Colorado. These are the micro hatches, and they come off heavy, and then they stop right away. So be prepared for that. And if you see that hatch, take notice of what bug it is, because then that means that they're feeding on those nymphs as well, right? Not just the dry flies.
Well, a question did come in from Dennis in Springfield, Missouri, and he said, what are the best dates for catching hatches and dry fly fishing? So is that... Do you want to answer his question? Is there a better time of year, or when you're getting more hatches?
Yeah, so it truly follows any other high altitude like hatch timing, and there's no secret to it. In early spring, unfortunately, at those high altitudes, the rivers are all choked up with ice and snow. But as soon as they come free of ice and snow, which it can be as early as late May, but usually in the latter part of June, you're going to see the rivers flowing truly free, you're going to see smaller, like blue-winged olives, all right, and maybe an occasional caddis. But as that water warms up and then the snow goes away, then you're going to be caddis, you're going to see terrestrials, all right, so the ants, the beetles, the hoppers, and early season, in late June and July, all those bugs are small. They haven't grown up yet. They grow through the summer. And then as you go into late July into August, everything's flowing. You've got the mayflies, variety of mayflies. I just refer to them as a gray drake because they're oftentimes larger, like a size 12. And that's pretty large for a Colorado mayfly at the high altitude. You just fish in Adams. You know, typical Adams does wonders for many different hatches up there. You'll see caddis all through the summer. You'll see hoppers, and they'll be bigger now. So you want to fish a size 10 maybe, you know, smaller is a size 12 or 14. And then as we get into late August into September, when things start to chill up and get first frost again, you're not going to see any mayflies anymore. You might see some blue-winged dahlias pop out every so often on a cloudy day. But then you get into what we call the October caddis or the late season caddis, and they're a little darker in color, a little smaller. And hoppers still work quite well, and ants clear into the fall season. So, but I often don't carry much. I'm a little different than Mike. Mike carries a lot. He's a guide. He's a fly shop owner. You know, he's prepared all the time. I carry one fly box, and it's got essentially the patterns I just talked about in there, plus a few of my own.
Okay. Running out of time here, but I did get one question here on the Internet that I plan to ask anyway. But Rob wants to know, have either of you fished IPWA using Tenkara methods? And I know you have a piece from Daniel Gallardo in your book about that. Do you guys want to address that?
Yeah, I've been fishing Tenkara for several years, and actually I'm good friends with Daniel, and you know, he lives in the Boulder area now, so we've managed to get out and sneak away and fish a few times. I find the Tenkara rod, particularly 11 or 12 foot in length, and there's a variety of models out there that support that length, is super effective for stream fishing, particularly the streams in Rocky Mountain National Park and in Peaks Wilderness. Oftentimes, the streams are just large enough where you can't hop over them or do a running jump safely, but you can extend your Tenkara rod out and touch the other bank and fish both sides. In fact, the front cover of the book is Mike took a picture of myself fishing Tenkara across the exact stream like that, where it's too wide to cross with by foot without getting wet. But a Tenkara rod, it just allows you to place that fly in the pocket water just perfectly. The downside to Tenkara is there's oftentimes a lot of wind in any piece of wilderness, and it's very difficult to manage your line to get that fly to get on the water effectively if you're fishing a dry fly. Now, if you're nymphing, it's a different story. You can sink your line and nymph effectively. I don't use Tenkara for lakes. I really like to sneak up on fish that are cruising, and I like to get the longer cast out there, and I find Tenkara is not as effective, certainly as effective for close-up fishing, but I like to get that longer cast out there.
Yeah, and for those listening in our archive, I did two different shows with Daniel Gallardo, who brought Tenkara basically to the U.S., and so you might want to check those out where he talks specifically about Tenkara fishing, and you might get some more guidance there if you're interested in that. So, but that's kind of what it was originally designed for, was small streams and creeks, so good application there. Well, good. I think we're out of time here. We do have a few more things to take care of. Any closing thoughts you guys want to throw in there before we button things up here?
I'd just encourage folks, if you don't have a copy of the book, you know, certainly get it. It would be super helpful. It helps you plan out your creating your own adventure. And if you have any questions, you know, feel free to reach out to us at the website for the book, and then you can reach us through a contact form. It's flyfish.peaks.com. And Mike and I will be happy to field your questions and help you answer through or get answers through any other things we didn't cover tonight.
Okay, yeah. So, again, it's www.flyfishthepeaks.com. So,
that's correct.
Make sure you guys get that. Okay, good. Well, Stephen, Mike, stick with me here. We're going to give away a copy of your book here in the next few minutes and some other things. So stick with me just a bit longer, and we'll finish things up. We're going to give away a one-year membership to Federation of Fly Fishers, and also a subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. And again, along with Stephen Mike's book, Fly Fishing Guide to Colorado Indian Peaks Wilderness Area. So stick with me a couple more minutes and we'll do just that. Family Ties, that's T-Y-E-S. Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website at www.familyties.com, familyties.com, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. And just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute to give us your feedback about the show. You can find the link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on the link and leave your comments. We truly appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away a few prizes. Winners of our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for the next show and so you don't miss out on the chance of winning one of these great prizes. If you are the lucky winner, we will contact you after the show to provide you with information on how to receive your prize. Okay, so the first thing we're going to give away tonight is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And Fed Fly Fishers is a great organization to be part of. If you don't win tonight, be sure to check them out. See what they're all about at fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org, where you can learn more about what they do for all of fly fishing across the world. So our winner there is, I'll get my computer going in, Jim Faber in Colorado. So, Jim, congratulations and winning that. I'm sure you'll enjoy it. If you already are a member, let me know. We can get you extended, so we'll contact you after the show to do just that. We'll give away now a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, which is published by Amato Books, and you can go to amatobooks.com and see all the publications they have, and as well as the books that they publish, and they've just got a wealth of information there. And we've got another person from Colorado, Victor Hahn. Victor Hahn, and thank you for playing, and congratulations on winning that subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal for 1 year. So congrats on that. Okay, now we're going to give away a copy of Stephen Mike's book and ask a few questions. You need to answer these questions in that form on our homepage where it says that you can ask questions. So use that same form that you've been using throughout the show and put in your answer, your name, and your location when you answer this. And the first person to get it right wins. And I may have you guys help me decide who the winner is here. Let me, there were seven areas that we talked about tonight, and which area was probably one of the easiest to access that we talked about? You can either give me a name, because it was kind of referred to by a name, or the actual area number, and that will win you a copy of the book. So I've got
hopefully
here,
we get somebody from other than Colorado.
Other than Colorado?
Yeah, we had two Colorado winners. We don't want to monopolize here. So.
Okay, so we had an answer that was Area 2. Would that be correct?
Yeah, let's take a look.
I was thinking of the area what we talked about that the 57-year-old could get to easily, and I don't think that was Area 2, was it?
No, we did talk about some locations in Area 2 are easy. There's some other more difficult ones, but there's one that's easier, so let's look for that one.
Yeah, I keyed on one that was what I considered to be a lot easier for somebody to get into.
And would that be Rainbow Lakes Area 4?
Actually, Rainbow Lakes Area 3, but yes, Rainbow Lakes would be.
Okay, do we want to give it to this participant?
Yeah,
or?
we don't expect him to know the areas, but he got it right. Rainbow Lakes.
Yeah, Rainbow Lakes was what I was looking for, and that's Ken in Lakewood. So we had one person answer prior to that, but it was Area 2, which was not the area we were looking for. But Rainbow Lakes is what I was looking for. So that would be Ken in Lakewood. So, Ken, congratulations. And he's close enough, he's going to use this book, I tell you.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll see him up there on the trails.
Yeah, yeah. So, Ken, what you need to do is send me a message back in the same text box you just used to answer the question and give me your full name and your mailing address so that Steve and Mike can send you out a copy of the book and we'll get that out to you. So thanks for listening and playing. I know that was maybe a little bit difficult, but get out there and explore. And for those of you outside of Colorado, we always welcome other fly fishers and give the area a try. Hey, Steve and Mike, it was great having you on the show tonight. It was a pleasure to talk to you both, and I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
And our next show will be on December 3rd, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, I'm going to interview Stephen Bird, and our topic for the show will be fly fishing the Upper Columbia River. Stephen calls the Upper Columbia River his home waters, where rainbow trout are known to reach 25 pounds. And he's been guiding there for many years and has found that many of the trout love to eat soft tackle and hairwing wet flies, swung and dangled. So join us to learn more about this incredible fishery and Stephen's unique approaches to fishing it. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Flat River Fly Shop, Front Range Anglers, Housatonic River Outfitters for sponsoring our show tonight. And don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.